Welcome. My name is Gilad Bernstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we bring together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build the world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually.
And so technology sort of flipped the script from how can we use this to how does it require us to use it? And that was one of his biggest kind of critical observations was eventually what he would call la technique is going to become something that rewires the behavioral processes of our brain and enforce behavioral codes on us that we don't even understand we're engaged with because of its mastery over our lived, in particular, our sort of experienced physical and relational and linguistic environments.
Hello, my name is Greg Cutsona, Executive Director of AI and Faith, and I'll be your podcast host for this episode. Today, I'm really excited to interview Luke Hartsock, co-founder and CEO of Gearvox, an agentic workforce company. Before that, he was the founder and CEO of Decisive Data, and he's also a part of the wider AI and Faith community. Now, we have a really interesting title for today, and it is this: The Golden Rule and the Narrow Path, Building AI That Keeps Its Word. I want to get right to Luke so you can hear from him. So let's get started. Luke, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Greg. Great to be here. Always enjoy having conversations with you and the broader AI and Faith community. Such an incredible audience and team of experts. It's really exciting.
Well, you know, every time I talk with you, I learn something new. And I'm quite sure that I'm going to learn at least one, two, or three things new today. And also, I find that you're such a brilliant and creative thinker. I end up talking really fast. So I'm going to try to suppress that and just be somebody that can be understood. So with that in mind and those ideas in my head, first, let the audience know, how did you become interested in AI and started your work in this field?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I've kind of a circuitous path to even get into technology entrepreneurship myself. This is actually my fourth company that I've started. And as most entrepreneurs know, if your batting average is better than 250, you're doing something right. So I have one out of those four that was a tremendous success from multiple people's perspective, including an acquirer. And as a result of that, that, as you mentioned, Decisive Data was a tremendous opportunity to build a really substantial team of technologists and data analytics consultants. And once that chapter closed, I took some time off. I got involved in the Seattle Techstars community, and that was right around kind of that blind alley that was opening up that sort of became visible as you went around it towards generative AI. So 2022, 2023. And as the pattern started to emerge, I'm a pretty early adopter type. And I just thought to myself, and prior clients and peers in the industry were asking me off the hand, you know, what's a good data strategy for AI? What am I supposed to do with all these AI tools? Like, where is this thing going? And ultimately, I started what has now become Gearvox because I was advising people on some of those ideas. But I thought, I want to actually build a platform that can deploy solutions that serve real customers and add real value to businesses using these tremendous generative AI capabilities. And so here we are a few years later. I think I'm about halfway to my 10,000 hours mastering that field since then.
That's wonderful. Yeah, well, I can imagine that, especially with the way that AI is continually changing, that those 10,000 hours are improvisational hours at some level. I want to ask you about maybe your early life, but is there anything else you'd like to add about your current work in AI?
I mean, there's plenty of stuff we can talk about in that regard. I would just say, having spent probably like my post-undergrad days were right around that sort of dot-com, dot-bomb loop, you know, the early aughts, and then seeing technology sort of ramp up from there through cloud computing. Really, you know, from my perspective as a tech nerd, Snowflake was a big breakthrough. The kind of high-speed online tabular and sort of maximal response latency databases that could migrate all the enterprise data that used to sit on physical devices into the cloud. That was kind of 09 to 2014 or 2015 by wide adoption. None of those really hold a candle to what I think the transformational power is of where generative AI can take not only the user experience for what the technology provides, but the kind of unlimited flexibility and potential for businesses and organizations. So I just view this, what a time to be alive and what a time to use responsible stewardship and sort of the right kind of character to apply towards this opportunity.
That's a really good word. And as you said, we've had conversations that precede this one, and that is certainly the ethos that you have. It just kind of is a theme throughout what you say. So maybe this is a point to step back. You know, where did you grow up? What's your early life like? And then, since this is a more personal question, you know, you can then move into whatever is relevant about your life outside of the work in your life today. But let's start with your early life. How did you grow up?
So I'm actually a proud pastor's kid. I'm one of three boys. The Reverend Dr. Charles Patrick Hartsock. Matter of fact, it's my dad's birthday today. I'm sure he'll listen to this eventually. Happy birthday, Pat.
Happy birthday, indeed.
And yeah, he spent 40 plus years in the Presbyterian Church. Started out as a assistant pastor to an amazing mentor in the Baltimore, Maryland area where I was born, and then planted a church from scratch. I always think of church planters as kind of faith-based entrepreneurs. And my dad definitely has the ability to carve a new path and do things that haven't been done before. And I think I inherited some of that from him as well. And my mom's an educator, has really always been involved in teaching and as a principal administrator, and now as a professor before she retired in her own right, educational administration. So yeah, myself and my three brothers grew up in a really vibrant, very church-oriented household. You know, we were the kind of family that had Young Life in our basement when I was in high school on Mondays and Campaigners on Tuesdays. You know how it is if you're a pastor's kid, you wind up spending half the day or more every Sunday doing church stuff, whether you like it or not. Indeed. But ultimately, I was also always kind of an early adopter of technology from the get-go. We had an Apple IIe in the 80s. I'm going to date myself, the green screen, the big monitor.
Wow, I love
the
that.
Amazing, you know, 64 megabyte hard drive back in the day.
Who would ever need any more than that, right?
And then always just found myself intrigued by the way you could leverage. I was actually the first kid in my high school to ever ask our librarian for an email account. She said, "Why do you want one of those?" And I said, "I don't know. I want to send an email to somebody." She says, "Just write them a letter." You know, that's kind of the era I grew up in. It's like, you know, right. tech is not common, you know, sort of like the Gen X, late Gen X era. And now tech is everywhere. And there was a time, I tell my kids, you know, everything was on a landline and there was no internet. There were no smart devices. And now look at us where we are today, 40, 50 years later. So that, you know, it's an interesting time to have that kind of 80s, 90s experience. And then, like I mentioned, kind of that just right out of my undergrad, sort of showing up on the Seattle tech scene when the kind of sheen had fallen off kind of all the dot-com allure, but still recognizing the amazing potential of what technology can do, whether or not the stock market agrees with you.
Yeah. Wow. That's a cool story. There's so much more I want to get into, but I do want to actually talk to you about something that you just did, in my mind just did at least, this recent presentation at a Jacques Ellul conference, if I got that right. And you drew together the ethics of this really profound 20th century thinker, philosopher, theologian, Jacques Ellul, with AI and its development. And I think one of the things about Ellul that's so fascinating is he really is one of the, you know, formative thinkers about how we receive technology. And many people, when they think of Ellul, pushback on technology, and yet you, as a technologist and a really profound thinker, you engaged him in a really fascinating way. So I'd love to hear how you bring together Ellul, AI, and ethics.
The Technological Society was one of Ellul's seminal texts that got probably his most well-known text. Matter of fact, the thing about Ellul is he wrote somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 books, about 30 some are translated to English. And he's such such a intentional thinker in terms of how he engages language. Every one of those books was either written by him, pen on paper, or with, as he aged, with somebody who actually either physically is a typewriter or took shorthand from him dictating. So he was not by any means a word processing guy on purpose. So Ellul was a professor in sociology, someone who would sort of build academic processes around understanding institutions and their effect on society. And he recognized very early in the 50s and 60s that the way things, just like manufacturing was changing, you know, technology was more or less causing human beings to change their behavior so that the assembly line was something that made people do certain things a way they wouldn't naturally do them. And so technology sort of flipped the script from, hey, you know, how can we use this to how does it require us to use it? And that was one of his biggest kind of critical observations was eventually what he would call la technique is going to become something that rewires the behavioral processes of our brain and enforce behavioral codes on us that we don't even understand we're engaged with because of its mastery over our lived, in particular, our sort of experienced physical and relational and linguistic environments. So without getting too far down the weeds, this particular conference was about one of his, I would say, like, well-known but not as well-heralded texts called The Humiliation of the Word. This was maybe kind of towards the tail end of his kind of peak scholarship. It was early 80s. I got to say, if you go back and read a handful of Ilul's texts from the 60s and 70s, there are incredibly incisive passages, almost like one sentence or two at a time, where if you just let it soak in for a moment and you realize kind of his prophetic position on the way he sees social things transcending the normal time and space continuum. He predicts TikTok. He predicts the impact of social media and disembodied language, that gross hypnosis of video imagery hijacking the kind of brain stem and the cortisol levels of human responses to stimulation in a way that's not natural. And it's kind of shocking in some ways to realize somebody could have seen that from such a non, very innovative intellectually, but not engaged in the realm of what technology could become. He saw it from the right kind of arm's length.
Wow. Yeah. And one of my friends, David Gill, is a Ilul scholar, and he's one of the first persons that got me familiar with Ilul. That was decades ago. And it's interesting now that I'm in this position as of about 10 months to think about Ilul and his ability to see forward so well. That's the nature of a great thinker. And then what I loved about what you did was you were then able to reinterpret Ilul and not just reapply, but integrate his thoughts into today's technology, which was amazing.
I just want to clarify, as far as the paper goes, I would say I kind of have like three kind of intellectual anchors, just to give a kind of, probably one of your few guests who doesn't have an advanced degree. I only have two bachelor's degrees, so no master's or PhDs here. But I have kind of three sort of different poles of my intellectual way I see the world. Ilul is kind of in one domain. And I would say I'm kind of letting that take more hold as I age and mature and see things from his wisdom perspective and tradition. I would say another one is René Girard, very influential thinker on me in terms of particularly his ability to see how sacrificial violence and the human social order was able to be kind of interpreted and unmasked by the experience of Jesus in the Gospels. And then I would say, even to be particularly theological or faith-based, is somebody like N.T. Wright, who's really kind of helped me to clarify kind of the higher order thinking of a Protestant that sees the full kind of spectrum of the covenantal God and the way that Jesus is the real new way to be human as far as God's covenant with man and humanity goes. So I would say on the Ilul front, the really shorthand for the paper was basically trying to respect and admit that Ilul has very good grounding for his objection to particularly images and multimedia distorting human thinking. But when it comes to language specifically, this idea of disembodied communication is a big sticking point for him. And so my thought has always been, Gearbox is a voice first, not voice only, but voice first AI agentic platform. So we struggle with the fact that we're putting something on a telephone or in a chat interface that people can hear and respond to. And in many cases, they may not know that it's not AI. Of course, one of our key kind of architectural principles are, if you ask, it will tell you. It discloses every time, no matter what. If you want to know if it's an AI, it will say readily, yes, I'm an AI assistant. This is not a person. If you want to continue the conversation, great. If you don't, I'd understand. But my thought was, how do you bring a new way to kind of mediate the training weights and the potential problematic spaces that happen inside of the AI state-of-the-art models, and then insert what effectively would be known as a system prompt? It's more complicated than that, but this just helps people with shorthand to override the underlying training weights and keep the context going towards a state awareness of the kind of quote-unquote person or agent, the job that that agent's doing in that conversation with that person. And so I wanted to sort of respect the Ilul's boundaries and then kind of extend kind of agency into the way AI could communicate with human beings that knows it's disembodied, but actually kind of metaphysically represents the commitments and keeps the words of the owner of, say, a body shop collision repair franchise, right? They have commitments to scheduling and estimates and bids and parts and insurance relationships. We're always going to ground that in real data, and it's never going to be made up or hallucinated. And it's also going to come with the ethos and the kind of the pathos of their culture. You know, how would their best agent sound on the phone? What kind of empathy would they express? What kind of connection would they want to establish with the customer? Can you instantiate that in AI agents? And so I presented a paper that kind of made the case that you can, Of course, there were plenty of scholars present that there was a few eye rolls, a lot of skepticism, and quite a bit of engagement. David Gill, in particular, I really appreciated his engagement and his thoughtfulness about that, because it's a real new frontier. I don't think Alul could have predicted, maybe anybody could have, the large language model impact on the way human society kind of perceives language itself.
Wow. I just want to say to those listening, this is why it's fascinating to talk with Luke. There are, you just saw that mind go into all these contexts and bring them together. That's what I love about talking with you. So that's my meta comment. I also appreciate the fact that you helped us understand that wider context, that it's not just Alul, but Girard and Wright are also really important. So one last piece I wanted to ask you about that you talked about in the paper, but I think it relates to wider things that you do, is if the Pope can refer to J.R.R. Tolkien in his recent encyclical, you can also do that, as you did with the Gandalf present part of your presentation. And I want to sound really smart here. So I think what you showed is that the context window is more important than training parameters. Is that true? Is that what Gandalf is about? Or what is the wider use of what you were doing with this Gandalf concept that you have?
Yeah, so I definitely am happy to share the fact that I am nerdy enough that something like the term Gandalf actually deserves a good, what I would consider in the parlance of ways that language can be interpreted, it's called a backronym. You basically find a word you want to kind of make an acronym out of and you back into it, right?
And so I love it.
Really, it's a generative agentic navigator for dialogue anchored learning frameworks. And obviously, as one can tell, those words are doing a lot of work to match the original spelling of the name Gandalf. But you really kind of did say something important there, Greg, which is the way that any user, and I would speak to kind of the most basic sort of ChatGPT single shot, hey, what's a good place to get Thai food near me now? Because you go there first rather than Google. For what it's worth, you're still going to get better results for Google localized services than, you know, ChatGPT or Gemini, but have at it. But really the multi-shot kind of longer form engaged conversations you can have with the AI agent, believe it or not, the training weights and the parameters included in every model now, some words, I think the estimate for Sonnet 5 was somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 billion plus parameters. If people know anything about the way that the common crawl and the weights and training works, they've essentially run out of internet training. There's no more digital content left that they haven't had either robots tell them not to, you know, robot text files don't crawl here, or everything else that they can, they've gobbled up and included in those training weights. Those are very, I would, you know, Andre Carpathy calls those kind of hazy recollections from something you may have read a while ago that you can't quite recall the exact connotation of. But when you put the context into the conversation, it literally is somewhere between 3 million to 30 million times more likely to orient the response algorithm, that ability to recall the next best guess of what the LLM is supposed to say, and orient the conversation to anchor it on that particular text. So the idea behind Gandalf was there were so many scholars there that were from the humanities. I wanted to give them sort of a working model of something they could wrap around a corpus of content that is something they're studying deeply. So say a book, a PDF, a series of papers, a bunch of research. And it basically creates sort of a conversational container to ground the way that the agent is constrained to respond to them back with, rather than have it go sort of pattern match and seek more deeply into those hazy recollections. So it's sort of a way to ensure no hallucination and true kind of in-depth engagement with a few texts in a corpus, rather than sort of wondering, can you actually sort of footnote and map back to where the source of this response came from?
Like you said, I'm still learning from what I learned, actually, what I heard from your talk, but by giving our queries more context, they'll become, as you said, much more accurate. For example, a thinker, if you give AI more material, it will be more accurate. It's the way I took it away as an end user. But you have probably more nuance to what that means.
I mean, I started out my little Gandalf. I gave everybody a sort of a QR code on my PowerPoint presentation at the talk. And if they scanned it, it went to a landing page that I created off of the Gearbox sort of content library. And the first thing that I said was, if you distrust generative AI in the academy, you know, this page agrees with you. Then it asks you to do something with the distrust, decides retreat. AI may have humiliated language. It sounds fluent. It's going to tell you what you want to hear. But the reason this Gandalf pattern might help, and I go ahead and actually quote a line from the encyclical where the Pope quotes Tolkien, is this idea that Gandalf is something that basically, you know, recognizes Gandalf's role in the Lord of the Rings, you know, universe, right? He's so powerful, yet he refuses to carry the ring because he doesn't want the power to actually have to make the choice on behalf of Frodo. So he's a bounded servant of the fire he did not make, and he works within the limits, which is exactly why his words can be trusted. So trust me, I'm a nerd. I came up with that alongside probably Claude Code, I forget. But the idea is you take this system prompt and the ability to point it at, say, a repo folder of the works that you're studying, and then it sort of insulates and sort of puts a kind of ring fence around the responses it's allowed to make. And it becomes a very good debate partner when you're trying to seek kind of a deeper insight about any one of those texts. And it really works across, I've used it for a whole bunch of research papers from the ever expanding research libraries of AI, large language model papers that get posted every day on the internet in some of the archives that are available. So you put a bounded set of content in there, you ground your conversation to focus on those exclusively, and then you can kind of go narrower and deeper than is normally possible without that kind of framework in the first place.
I love that. I mean, again, to me, that was a very practical thing. And it was also really fascinating back to learning from what you offer and what you bring. Now, stepping back a little wider, the title, The Golden Rule and the Narrow Path, Building AI that Keeps Its Word. And I'm interested in some of the broader aspects of the influence and the effect of AI on our world today and perhaps on our own psyche, soul, all that sort of thing. I'm giving you a wide question so you can decide which part do you want to, you know, focus on.
So I'm going to kind of stay in my lane. I think there's some practicality. I mentioned this to you when we met a few days ago to kind of discuss this conversation, but one of my discoveries I made in my adolescence, I have never met my father's parents. Unfortunately, they both passed away when he was in his late teens, early 20s. But his father was an applied astrophysicist for Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab in the DC area and helped work on the early DoD responses to Sputnik. So he always was biased towards, he's a brilliant man, but action-oriented. He didn't write research papers. He didn't spend much time in the academy. He just built stuff. He tinkered with stuff. And he got in trouble sometimes for doing it, maybe too hastily. Maybe I have some of that in me. And so trying to apply AI in the real world is something I find more compelling than researching or hypothesizing about it. So to your response, and I would say applying generative AI in real world use cases where you actually have the, I would say, like virtual touch points between agents and people is where I think the real insights come from. And so the Gearbox platform facilitates, as of right now, potentially 30,000 plus conversations every month. There's probably hundreds of them that'll occur just today, maybe dozens in this time that we're meeting, where once you get a chance to review the way that the kind of human-computer interaction occurs, you start to get a sense of what builds trust with people when they're engaged with agentic AI, what causes them to lean in or to push back, what allows them to understand they're talking to something that's highly competent, that has the right amount of context, and that really drives towards an objective that the business that deployed it has without sounding transactional or they're kind of force feeding somebody down a path. And so when I think about AI applied to those real world situations, the golden rule is, how would I want that to go if I were them? How do I want to be spoken to by something that potentially is a lot smarter than me? It's an interesting question to ask. Even if you bound an agentic AI and put the guardrails up so you can't go, you've all seen the TikToks, right? You call some barbershop and an AI answers and you ask it for a cupcake recipe and it starts reading back to you how to bake cupcakes because you got around. That's all just shenanigans and vaporware. Our agents are industrial grade, you know, SOC 2 compliant, very, very tightly bounded and deliver a ton of value, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in revenue handled for customers on a monthly basis right now. And yet the words that they utter, the phrases that they speak, the responses that they tabulate from grounded real world sources of data, API calls to CRM systems or scheduling mechanisms or pricing tables or calculations to figure out when the technician's actually going to arrive based on their current route to get where you are. If you don't do that well, why should anybody feel any better about trusting that than somebody who's just BSing them to get them to buy something over the telephone if they're a terrible telesalesperson, right?
Right.
And so I just think, to me, the narrow path idea is, you know, Silicon Valley is kind of famous for moving fast and breaking things. Maybe one of the reasons I don't have a lot of Silicon Valley investors is I don't do that. I don't think that's the right way to do business. I think being intentional and taking the kind of long view, the wide path that so many people go down, maybe you stack up a bunch of MRR real quick and you get a whole bunch of churn. Maybe you have some proof points in your investor deck that you have 1,000 new customer ads this quarter, and you don't mention that 70% of them came and went within 60 days because your service was transactionally oriented towards what the business needed and not really what the customer wanted. And I just think there's a different way, a less common practice that you can use to continuously refine and engage with people where they are in terms of who they are, how they want to be brought along on that journey. And to me, that's just something that you have to kind of have as a first principle when you're designing agentic platforms.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, there's so much there that connects with, you know, deep concerns of yours, but also deep concerns of mine. And one of them is, you know, bringing in the golden rule. You're saying, here's this formative teaching of Jesus, and how can it actually be instantiated in the work that I do in AI? And there's a certain amount of awe I feel just in hearing the way you're working with that, because in the world that I live in, and I think it's fairly well represented with statistical analysis of our country, a lot of people are very hands-off about AI and don't even want to go there because there's a fear. And you're saying, no, let's lean in, and let's lean in with these values that are critical for us, which I'm not trying to make a plug for AI and faith, but that's exactly a key part of our mission, is bringing theological religious ethics to the development and the conversations about AI. So anyway, I really think that's quite something. And in this process, have you felt that there's some roadblocks that have happened, or the things on that way that have made this difficult to bring in the golden rule?
Great question. I would just say I'm a big fan of the Gospels, and I do find a lot of my meaning in life through the teachings and life of Jesus. And I think that the amount of times in the scriptures themselves, you have these kind of twin imperatives: do not fear, and God is love. Perfect love drives out all fear. And I just think if the core ground of all being, it can be embodied as the one true human and inspire people across all walks of life. You know, the majority of Jesus's empowering followers might have been the first dozen disciples, but there were at least a dozen women and people that were not from the inner circle of the right sort of clique of the day that he followed through with and built relationships with across multiple castes and classes and different categories of people, because he lived a fearless life and he had a purpose to declare the arrival of the kingdom, his version of casting what it meant to be a new human in a renewed long-term perspective that lives for the fullness of life. That should affect, I think, the way an entrepreneur approaches their journey in business, not to be didactic or apologetics or fundamentalist. I don't have anybody, you know, I find no compunction to want to compel somebody to believe exactly what I believe. I think that's sort of low fidelity abiding. I think that's sort of, that might even be a fear-based assumption. If they don't believe what I believe, what's going to happen to them? I don't think that way. I just think God has given us a critical capacity to see what is possible. Matter of fact, I listened to Dr. Dalrymple, the Templeton Foundation guest you all had a while back, recently when I was talking about this podcast. And I do find his techno-optimism maybe outpaces mine just a little bit. and you know, the Allul factor might be a tell there, right? Because I think there's a judiciousness. When I don't know how often he's in the weeds working on developing agentic AI directly that has to directly impact real world human lives. But man, the closer you get to that hot stove, right, the more you have to make sure it's the right temperature to cook stuff at the right level, right? You do not want to have the sort of chaos and confusion that can occur when AI is not wired up to do the right thing. That's something that I find it to be important. No fear, but a lot of discernment.
Right. Well, I'm inspired by this, and I just think it's really, really important. And I'm glad you're in this world. I mean, I think this world of AI and agentic AI. I wanted to just give you one opportunity before I go to a final lightning round, which is a part of the habit of this podcast. Are there some things that our listeners should know about AI that I haven't asked you about, or that you just think, oh, this is something I really would like to say about AI, agentic AI, et cetera? Again, open-ended, take it where you will.
two observations and one offer. So one observation is the models, they matter, but they're all so competitively wired to ever rapidly sort of eclipse one another. First of all, the benchmarks and index of how to classify a really good model only matter to like me, the 9,999 people that do this stuff every day, but they actually do tell a really interesting story about the capabilities of these models. If you're using Gemini or Claude or ChatGPT or Perplexity, or hey, more power to you, if you're nerdy enough to go to open source models, you know, do that, right? But know that the capabilities and the general training corpus is fairly congruent across these models. I would say try to remember things like you can invoke within your ChatGPT or your Claude account, I use those more than others, memories. You can actually ask it very directly. If you have an aha insight in a long form conversation, hopefully you're front loading that with a lot of context you want it to care about, rather than just trusting it to go single shot a lot of hazy recollection weights from its own data set. But if you say, look, that was really meaningful, I want to have you know that what we just came to in a conclusion together matters to me, you know, log that in the ledger, in my memories. If you're doing it in VS Code and Claude Code, you know, again, a rare error, but if you are, the ledger's continuously being updated, and have it do more to reflect kind of what you want to do going forward to personalize that experience. I would say the other thing is, this is just broad stroke advice. There's a lot of fear and trepidation about AI and education. I've got four daughters. They're all school age, high school and undergrad. I give my kids one maxim. Okay. Do not let these generative AI platforms think for you. Bring your original work that responds to the assignments you've been given by your teachers and instructors to them if you need help having them augment and assist you to improve the originality of your work. If you make them think for you, you will become less capable and intelligent. If you have them help you along your way in the right way with discernment, you will find it extends your learning powers. I think that's kind of an important word for a lot of people.
Yeah, listen to that, parents. That's good advice from an AI developer. So there we go.
Yeah, and then this is a very nerdy concept, and if people want to follow up, I think I'm going to leave a few links behind in the bio, or you can try to find me on wherever. I don't do much social media stuff, but maybe I have a LinkedIn post about this. If Claude ever responds with the phrase like, that was a very load-bearing concept in your argument, or it has some weird sort of, you know, semicolon conclusive, you know, exclamation point argumentative frame that just keeps repeating itself in a way that feels like Claude-ish in the worst sense of the word for, you know, language being kind of, you know, hard to follow or sort of frustrating, I have a mechanism I've developed, and you could do this on the fly with your AI agent, and it'll work free form. There's a thing called stylometry. It's a very weird linguistic term for the patterns of language that represent the way that a certain person's fingerprints look if you read their words at a larger scale. It's kind of like the sentence structures, vernacular, and sort of ways that you use language to write and communicate the written word, because the large language models are all dependent upon a literal written text. So I built this stylometry index to basically have a resource for how you create outputs. And it basically takes a whole sample set of your writings. And I particularly like to think about people's writings before they started using generative AI. So you kind of bookmark, when did I start using it? And it goes back and looks at a bunch of your emails and Google Docs or Word Docs in Office 365 or the cloud. And it'll tabulate your best sort of Hall of Fame writings and different classifications of how you write personally, professionally, inspire, instruct. And then it'll basically say, okay, look, I see what your writing is actually like when you write really well, when you communicate as yourself. How about I now adopt that as your stylometric index? So when I respond to you, it fits the way your writing would be willing to be shared with others rather than the way I talk as the agent. I just think there's a lot of people looking for a way out of kind of those weird kind of word games that I think AI does when it communicates. It gets a little hackneyed. And I think there's just, you know, there's better ways to do that as well.
I love that. Yeah. To humanize it. One of the phrases I use is to let it serve us and we don't serve it. Well, final lightning round. This has been such a great conversation. I will go to our lightning round. Is there anything fun you did this summer or are still yet to do?
Two things. I grew up as a very competitive basketball player, and on and off throughout my adult life, I have played sporadically, been raising a lot of children and running a lot of businesses. I've started playing very competitive basketball again on a weekly basis and absolutely loving the feeling kind of the player coach, go out and win, give your best. It's so much fun. It's just so life-giving to me to you know, be able to still do that well and enjoy sport. Another thing is we're just taking our second oldest daughter off to start her undergraduate education at Marquette, wonderful Jesuit school in Milwaukee, next week. And then my oldest daughter is leaving for Spain to go study abroad. So prepping them to kind of go do adulting things and live their lives in the world. It's exciting and transitions are hard. So, you know, there's some trepidation in that for us. We try to live without the fear. And then, you know, as far as sort of where sort of I try to spend my time when I'm not working so many hours a day, I think my wife and I could use a few more walks through the ravine together, enjoying Seattle's beautiful summertime.
Yeah, I love that. There's a lot there. Obviously, you have many different interests, and which is a great part. That to me is a rich life. You know, you can enjoy lots of different things. Final piece is, what's your favorite personal use case for AI?
Well, I've already shared a few. I would say one thing I do better is I tend to use a lot of the speech to text tools to kind of have it type or write for me. And I've started to accrue an homage to that sort of good writing index. I basically just have a way of sort of accumulating the kind of things I think about and meditate on in my personal, spiritual, and sort of longer form thought life. And then I kind of stitch those back together in some ways, almost to allow me to remember the true, the beautiful, and the good in my own life at times when I need to be reminded of that. So it's sort of like my meditations and reflections on truth and beauty and goodness that I kind of store up. And then there are times where I'll sort of like remind myself, both by triangulating it with content that I'm reading, things that I care about, and just things that I know to be true. One of my favorite things in our neighborhood, we live with a number of about a half dozen, maybe almost a dozen families in our U District neighborhood in Seattle, is if you stopped any one of our teenage kids on the street and you said, what's the most important thing to you? They would all say that I'm loved. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, we want to instantiate just as parents and friends and mentors and connected community members. And so sometimes I need to hear that. And so I allow myself to sort of reference something I've already kind of parked in sort of a reusable content library and sort of combine it with stuff that keeps me motivated for all the things that I care about, think about, and love.
That's a great place to end. I'll just say thank you, Luke Hartsock, that we've had this great conversation. And I'm glad that you've been able to share your thoughts with our AI and Faith wider audience. So really enjoyed this time together today. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Really appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.